I'm Dan Rundy. This is another episode of Building the Future with Dan Rundy. I'm here with Hank Meyer, the author of Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Hank, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure, Dan.
So, Hank, you have a day job, and this was sort of a labor of love. You're not a full-time author, but you were a reporter and an editor at another point in your life, and I could see that you're an excellent writer and researcher. How did you end up doing this?
Arthur Vandenberg may be the most important political figure of the 20th century for whom there was no biography. Bit of a long story, but I had done a biography of my grandfather, who was a radical Dutch immigrant turned entrepreneur in Michigan, and loved the biographical format. And one of the most important people to come out of Grand Rapids, my hometown, was this senator named Arthur Vandenberg, who 20 years ago, if you walked down the street at Monroe Avenue in Grand Rapids and said, "Who was Arthur Vandenberg?" people there would say, "Well, was he related to the jewelry store?"
Right.
He was not. But he never lived long enough to write his own memoir, and he'd been a journalist. Two would-be biographers died, and by a curious circumstance, I inherited the research of the second one of those two. And so suddenly what had been a local curiosity became a sense of mission, and 26 years ago, I'm embarrassed to say, I embarked on researching the life of Arthur Vandenberg.
When was this published?
Last fall, November.
Oh, my word. So this was a long labor of love.
Well, I had a day job.
You had a day job. You probably had other commitments going on.
Yes, indeed.
So what is your day job?
Our family is in the retail business in the upper Midwest, Meijer Incorporated, M-E-I-J-E-R. We operate retail super centers, and I'm executive chairman now of the company.
So you kind of have your hands full doing that.
It can easily be an all-consuming activity, but I've managed at points over the years to find enough time to commute to Ann Arbor, where Vandenberg's papers are, and to, in the early stages in my relative youth, to interview people who were still alive and knew him then.
Really? And did you have a researcher help you at all?
I did not. I only at the end when I was
That's
compiling.
That's very Dutch thrifty of you.
Well, it's not intentional. I didn't have either the academic or maybe the forethought to do that. But at the end, when my footnotes, which are all on index cards in recipe boxes from 20 years ago, hopelessly disorganized, I did have a researcher at the Bentley Library at the University of Michigan help me coordinate and compile
those. That was out of an act of mercy.
Oh, it was an act of desperation.
Was it desperation? Okay, so who is Arthur Vandenberg? So the way I came to this and the reason I wanted to have you on is because I read a new book that came out in the last 18 months about the Marshall Plan by Ben Steele, which you may or may not have seen.
I have, yes.
And so what shook me to my core, because I thought I knew the story, was that I knew absolutely nothing about Arthur Vandenberg. I'm a Republican, and I could totally identify with Arthur Vandenberg. I also thought, okay, this person was really the main driver and the architect of so much of the liberal international order that we are all beneficiaries of. And, you know, this person has gotten zero attention or doesn't get the credit he deserves. And some of it is, I think, because no one had actually written a biography about him. So I said, well, who's written one? And so I had someone go on Amazon, and we found your book, and I bought it retail, I want you to know.
Oh, bless your heart.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think that it's quite an interesting story. So who is Arthur Vandenberg?
Arthur Vandenberg was a senator from Michigan, Republican senator from 1928 until his death in 1951. And he made his name, actually you could say he made his name domestically, pushing through against Franklin Roosevelt's objections the legislation that created the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, growing out of his involvement in the Detroit banking crisis at the onset of the Depression. As time wore on in the New Deal, and he flipped from being an early supporter of some of the New Deal as a Republican trying to survive in a state that was increasingly less Republican, he recoiled at the second New Deal, became a bitter opponent of FDR, and that opposition carried over into a mistrust of Roosevelt's intentions in foreign policy. Vandenberg, as so many of his generation, had come away disillusioned after backing Wilson's great crusade in World War I to make the world safe for democracy, had argued for changes to the Covenant to the League of Nations as an editorial writer and editor in Michigan, and had actually supplied some of the language for William Henry Cabot Lodge used in fighting the League of Nations in the Senate. he'd grown increasingly isolationist, and distrust of Roosevelt only exacerbated that, so that in the late 1930s, particularly after the death of William Borah in 1940, who'd been one of his mentors, he became the most outspoken of the Republican isolationists and, in effect, the leader of the isolationist bloc among Republicans in the Senate.
So Arthur Vanderbilt was originally an isolationist.
Hardcore. A believer in absolute neutrality. His lifelong hero was Alexander Hamilton, and the notion of Washington's farewell address that Hamilton had written arguing against entangling alliances, he took to heart. That became his lodestar as Roosevelt is beginning to angle for support for the endangered democracies in Europe.
And so what did he think when Pearl Harbor happened? What was Arthur Vandenberg's reaction to that as an isolationist?
His flip reaction was that ended isolationism for any thinking person that day. That's a gross simplification, and it certainly muted the debate during the course of the war over to what degree the United States should be engaged in the world because we were suddenly engaged in a global war. But he and others knew that that debate, and particularly within the Republican Party, the schism between the adherents of Wendell Willkie, who of course famously was nearly as interventionist as Franklin Roosevelt in 1940, and the traditional isolationists like him, that would reemerge after the war. And so he found himself shaken by Pearl Harbor and then making gradual changes over the course of the war. And I would argue one of them was trying to put together a Republican platform in 1943 for the Republicans to run on in 44.
So there's a section in the book about a meeting in Michigan, I think.
Yes.
Is this the meeting that you're referring to?
Yes.
Talk about this meeting and what is this? Because I think this was sort of an important moment in American foreign policy, because this was sort of the moment when somebody in the Republican Party had to sort of move the Republican Party move it away from isolationism. This was the moment, isn't it?
It was. And two things are happening concurrently. First of all, when Willkie ran in 1940, he was not an establishment Republican.
This is the Republican who ran against FDR in 1940.
Correct. And he runs, he'd never been elected to office as a Republican. He'd been a Democrat until 6 months before and was highly suspect and, of course, had not succeeded. And so the establishment Republicans are split between the Wilkieites and the isolationists as they approach the election in 1944. So in 1943, the RNC chairman calls a meeting of the leading Republican elected officials at Little Mackinac Island in northern Michigan and assigns Arthur Vandenberg to chair a foreign policy group to bring this fractious party together so they have something to run on in 44 and try to regain some strength against Roosevelt. It's happening at a time when the tide of war has turned in favor of the Allies, and Americans are beginning to wonder what a role will be after the war. And in doing so, ideas are bubbling up from editorial pages and in Congress with plans for, do we have a world organization, of world federalism? What can we do differently than what happened after World War I? And Roosevelt, as Dr. Win the War, is suppressing Democratic debate on that issue. People like William Fulbright, who's in Congress soon to go into the Senate from Arkansas, these are leading internationalists, and they want to introduce resolutions about what might happen after the war. And Roosevelt says, no, 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 no. So the Democrats are suppressed in a sense, as Roosevelt is worried about fracturing the Allies.
And the House and the Senate are both under Democrat control?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And Roosevelt's biggest concern is, I don't want to alienate the British, because if we start talking about justice and independence, they've got an empire they want to reconstruct. I don't want to alienate the Russians, because if we start talking about sovereignty and justice, they have their own designs on Eastern Europe. And so let's just keep things quiet
for a little while till we finish the war.
Right. But then you've got the Republicans trying to figure out something to run on, and they come out
For 44.
For 44.
So this is 43, and they're starting to think about, we expect to win the war.
Right. And what's going to happen?
And what are we going to do in 44, and what happens if we win?
Right.
And that's what's driving all this.
And so Vandenberg, trying to find a compromise, as he put it, between 49 prima donnas, and these included governors like Earl Warren in California, senators like Robert Taft in Ohio, his compromise between the world federalists and the isolationists was to come out with a very mild, really milquetoasty message in favor of Republican support for an international organization after the war. And it really filled a vacuum because the Democrats hadn't been saying that in any public way. And so Vandenberg suddenly finds himself lionized on the editorial pages for having come out in favor of a post-war organization. So this is pulling him out of his isolationism. So is his nephew, Air Force General Hoyt Vandenberg, who is emerging as one of the young strategists of modern aerial warfare.
Vandenberg Air Force Base. That's named after Hoyt, not Arthur.
Exactly. And Hoyt's meeting with him, and he's understanding isolation, which Pearl Harbor drove a temporary stake through, is going to become increasingly impossible in what he called a foreshortened world. And so...
And foreshortened world means what?
Means... Things are closer together. The ocean.
We're gonna, we can't. We
the oceans are no longer
oceans anymore.
Right.
That with nuclear weapons or sort of long technologies are not going to protect us from the world outside our borders.
Right. And of course, coincident with that is our dominance as emerging from the war as the overwhelming economic power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, what is the agreement that he cobbles together in all of this?
The agreement really is a very mild one, expressing Republican support for a post-war organization. So I cited
meaning the UN.
Meaning what becomes the UN. And so that really is...
With some caveats.
Oh,
is it sort of
course.
Like we're going to maintain our sovereignty. These folks, this is not going to be a global government that's going to supersede the Constitution. There seem to be, if I recall, there were like a lot of caveats.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, it is hemmed in on every angle. It's not going to be
There's
a Wilkie.
There's going to be a world court that's going to do an international arrest warrants.
Right.
Right?
Because you've got Wilkie folks and some in the Democratic Party who are arguing for more of a world federalism.
A world government.
Correct. Or
a European Union style supranational
and
government.
A world police force, things like that.
Right. And he's not arguing that.
No, no.
He's arguing we're going to retain our sovereignty, but we're going to cooperate a lot.
Yeah. We won't do what we did after World War I.
To recall, in World War I, Wilson got sick and had a stroke and wasn't able to finish the job of convincing the American people, or at least, and I think Republicans in the Congress, to support the League of Nations.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I believe FDR was at the negotiations for the League of Nations, so he had a 50-yard seat on seeing all of this fall apart. And so he had all of that in the back of his mind as well.
Right. And Wilson had led his own delegation to the peace conference at Versailles and made two fatal mistakes. One was the delegation included no prominent Republicans.
So being bipartisan is a good idea. I can't remember if the Republicans had control of either the House or the Senate at the time.
Control flipped in 1918. The Republicans had just taken control of the Senate.
So if he had been smart, he'd have had somebody from the Republican Party come with him, and he didn't do that.
Right. And so that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was to say, here's the League Covenant, the charter, and I've committed us to it, and we're not going to change a word in it. Right.
That's crazy. So FDR knew all of that. So a couple of things about the Versailles Conference. The Versailles Conference, I think, was the last global conference that was conducted in French.
Oh.
And the UN, the San Francisco Conference, the Bretton Woods Conference, and I'm going to talk about the Bretton Woods Conference in a minute, and you know probably know a lot about this, were conducted in English. So there was that was sort of the switch. But I know the Bretton Woods Conference was held in New Hampshire because FDR wanted the support of a key senator from New Hampshire for the Bretton Woods.
Was it Toby?
Somebody, yeah. And said, we'll do it in New Hampshire. You pick the place.
Well, and in fact, I think some people said Vandenberg should have been on the American delegation, but they wanted the home state senator.
Right.
Be the same logic.
That was the logic. And mm-hmm. There must have been a similar logic to the San Francisco conference that set up the UN.
I think there were places arguing to be host cities, and San Francisco won out.
Yeah, but there must have been somebody on the Hill. There must have been some member of Congress from California that he was trying to take care of or something like that. It wouldn't have just been... There must have been some other angle. We'll have to figure that out.
It's a great question.
That's a great question, right? So I think that's... Anyway, so the point is he shapes this, coming back to this, the Mackinac Island Conference. Is that what it was called?
The Mackinac.
The Mackinac Conference, that he leads the Republicans out of a policy of isolationism. How long had it been broadly isolationist as a platform? For 30 years? For 40 years?
Really from... The rejection of the League of Nations Covenant.
So 1918.
1920.
So 25 years it had been a reliable isolationist party.
Yes. There was a splinter within the party, or Wilkie wouldn't have emerged as he did.
So for 25 years. So that's the moment when the Republican Party turns away of 25 years of isolationism is the Mackinac.
Mackinac Conference takes a baby step.
A baby step in that direction. Lots of caveats saying we're open to the idea of a United Nations.
But a spotlight shining on the baby step because the Democrats, who were more preponderantly in favor of the UN, weren't talking about
it. Right. There were some in the Democratic Party who wanted something that wasn't going to be politically feasible. So this was important to kind of create a political opening.
Right. And okay. So then the...
This is in 43.
This is in 43, right.
So we fast forward a little bit. So when does Vandenberg is in the Senate starting in 28? Is he the lead Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1943? So he's the minority. He's the...
The ranking
yes. member.
Yeah.
And so when does the Senate flip to Republican?
1946.
Okay. So in 44, FDR wins the election. In 1945, we win the war. So then a series of things begin to happen.
And actually, they happen before the end of the war. Roosevelt wins the election in the fall of 44. And in January of 45, at the end of January, he is departing for Yalta for a summit with Stalin and Churchill.
Right.
And so,
when is Bretton Woods? Isn't that in the fall of 44?
I believe it is.
Yeah. I think it's the fall of 44. So even before Yalta, there's the Bretton Woods.
Correct.
And I don't remember when San Francisco was.
San Francisco was the spring of 45, right after Roosevelt dies.
Okay. So Bretton Woods is also sort of a pregame. It's like, how are we going to think about international economic stability?
Right.
How we're going to rebuild Europe, which is the world. So economic stability is going to be the IMF. How we're going to rebuild Europe, the IBRD, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is basically about rebuilding Europe. And the third is the General Agreement on Trade, GATT, which later morphs into the World Trade Organization, the three Bretton Woods institutions that are there called. There's a meeting at the Bretton Woods Hotel. Does he go to the Bretton Woods conference?
No, he's not a part of that. But there's a concurrent meeting that he's also not a part of, but that is laying the future groundwork, and that is at Dumbarton Oaks here in Washington.
It's like the planning meeting for that?
Right. That's like the bureaucrats at the State Department level.
And Treasury.
Beginning to talk about a world organization.
Oh, for the UN.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So there's
a planning meeting for San Francisco is at Dumbarton Oaks. And then there's the process at, and so there's a fabulous book. Actually, Ben Steele also wrote this book, another book called Battle of Bretton Woods, I think it was, which is about the Bretton Woods Conference. And that's, I think, how he got into the Marshall Plan. Anyway, so, which I encourage people to read. But so the story is that I think FDR did not think much of his Secretary of State.
FDR had run, he had really sort of ignored the State Department throughout the war. I mean, when there were missions to Moscow or to Churchill in England, he was sending Harry Hopkins.
Right.
Cordell Hull was sidelined.
Right. So he was very friendly with his Secretary of the Treasury. And so the Bretton Woods work was given to the Treasury almost by historical accident because he liked his Secretary of the Treasury more than he liked his Secretary of State.
And his Secretary of the Treasury was not particularly competent, Henry Morgan thought.
Right, and so that it was all outsourced to...
Harry Dexter White,
who, so let's just for the record, was a Soviet spy, right? This has been proven, historically proven. So our point person on the Bretton Woods process was a Soviet spy. And so he denied it and he died shortly thereafter. But the reason we did not get control of both the World Bank and the IMF, we were going to get both at the end of the war. And it's a pity we didn't get both because you'd think now today in 2018, you would think that this is some birthright of the Europeans to have the IMF because we get all sorts of crap, and that's a think tank term, for having control of the World Bank. We were going to get both. And Harry Dexter White, that perfidious spy who betrayed the United States of America, was going to get the job. And so because they knew he was a spy, but they didn't want to tell him and let on to his KGB masters that he was a spy, they said, you know, we're going to give it to a Belgian. So the first head of the IMF was a Belgian, and that created the tradition of it being a European, unfortunately, for the United States of America. And they said, you know, Harry Dexter, we're going to make you the U.S. ambassador equivalent to the IMF, which is called the executive director to the IMF, which was a less important job. And it was more because they knew he was a spy, but they didn't want the KGB to catch on that they knew. And so that's how that all happened. And Truman later came out and said that. So there's a interesting historical accident. Yeah. Anyways, sorry it's an aside, but so you have Dumbarton Oaks. How does Arthur Vandenberg intersect with Dumbarton Oaks, which is the planning process for the San Francisco meeting, which leads to the United Nations?
Dumbarton Oaks is preliminary work.
It's bureaucrat planning.
So what you have is the Roosevelt, soon after his inauguration, announces plans to go to Yalta, meet with Stalin and Churchill, where now in January of 45, it's no longer a question of winning the war. We're months away from that. It's a question of what's going to happen after the war. We've had some preliminary work at Dumbarton Oaks, and now we're planning for a United Nations organizing conference in San Francisco in May of 1945. Vandenberg, nursing his long distrust of FDR, doesn't know what kind of deals he plans to cut with Stalin and Churchill. So he stands up in the Senate.
In Yalta.
Yalta. He stands up in the Senate on January 10th, 1945. This is his coming out, in a sense, away from isolationism, because the other had been relatively more behind the scenes, advocating a post-war alliance with the Russians and the British and the French to keep Germany demilitarized. What he's really trying to do is flush out Russian intentions and say, you don't need to take over Poland as a buffer state, because we will join with you to make sure that the Germans are not again going to be aggressors. Roosevelt poo-poos the speech, but orders 50 copies to bring along to Yalta at the last minute. Roosevelt goes to Yalta. Of course, he's in poorer health than any of us realize. And I think at Yalta is probably beginning to realize that his hopes of cooperation with Stalin are not panning out.
Yeah.
And his new Secretary of State, Stettinius, who succeeded Cordell Hull, who was a former U.S. Steel executive and a by all accounts, a competent manager of the State Department, but not a strong foreign policy figure, is convincing him on the way back from Yalta, listen, that delegation you sent to San Francisco has to include Arthur Vandenberg. You can't make the mistake, and Roosevelt knows this grudgingly too. I can't make the mistake Wilson did after World War I, not bringing a prominent Republican under the tent. So he appoints Vandenberg to the 6-member delegation. Vandenberg, Tom Connelly, who the Democrat from Texas who chaired foreign relations at that time, their House counterparts, and then the former boy wonder governor of Minnesota just out of the Navy, a fellow named Harold Stassen, and the Virginia Gildersleeve, the president of Barnard College. That's the American delegation. Roosevelt comes back from Yalta, and in April in Warm Springs, Georgia, he dies. Harry Truman, of course, famously had had lunch once with Roosevelt since the election, total neophyte in foreign policy, decisive to the point of saying, well, we're going to go ahead with next month in San Francisco with this conference, but he won't go himself. He's not going to make the Wilson mistake. With a weak Secretary of State, a president who's completely inexperienced, Vandenberg goes to San Francisco as the most influential American delegate. And as an aside, the votes in San Francisco are going to depend heavily on the Latin Americans, because so much of the rest of the world either is a colony or an occupied state or a member or allied with the Axis powers. And so the Americans, to get their way in points of debate over the UN charter, need Latin American votes. The Assistant Secretary for Latin American Affairs is Nelson Rockefeller. Vandenberg brings along with him as his own advisor John Foster Dulles. It's those three Republicans, I would argue, who were calling the shots for the American delegation, quite a departure from what anyone would have expected in sitting across the room in the Fairmont Hotel penthouse.
So that's wild. So you have the conference, and it's largely, you could say, it's a successful conference.
It is. We wrangle with Russia over the veto.
A Security Council veto. Five countries that are permanent members of the Security Council have vetoes.
Right.
And China, Russia, France, Britain, and the United States of America.
Correct. And we argue over opportunities to create regional security arrangements, because we have in mind the Latin Americans.
The OAS.
But it is a successful conference. Everybody signs on, and Vandenberg comes home back to Washington with his baby, the UN Charter, to deliver to the Senate. And of course, Truman also is astute politically and knows that to get this treaty through the Senate, even though the Republicans are still in the minority.
This is 45.
In 45, he needs Republican votes. And so Vandenberg is celebrated, played up to from that angle as well, because
he needs the votes.
The administration needs him, right?
So let's fast forward to, so 1946 happens. The election of 46 happens. You've had the UN conference. You've had the Bretton Woods conference. We've won the war. Truman is now president, but Arthur Vandenberg becomes chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Correct.
So then things start going south in two ways in Europe. The first is the issue of the reconstruction is not going fast enough. Sort of drifts, if I can put it that way. It's listless or drifts from sort of 45, 46, maybe even 47.
We're doing a little bit of emergency aid,
but that's about it.
But it's drifting. The continent is devastated.
The continent is devastated. And so the book, the Marshall Plan book, describes that. But there's a moment where what I think is the wake-up call is that there's some elections. I can't remember if it's Greece or it's Turkey or Italy. But the communists win or almost win, and people start saying, wait a minute, you were talking earlier about that we're not going to have the kind of relationship we want with the Soviet Union or the Russians, and we're going to have to rethink how we're going to do things. So Arthur Vandenberg is sort of called up for duty for sort of two big components, and I think they're linked, is we're going to have to rebuild Europe, and we're going to have to create some kind of forms of security guarantees for Europe.
Correct.
So talk about those two things. And what does he do? Because I think this is quite interesting.
A case could be made that the Cold War actually began before the Hot War was over, when the American public is still understanding, picturing the Soviets as our allies. But in that penthouse in San Francisco, Vandenberg and Molotov are going toe-to-toe over how the world's going to be organized. And the Soviet intransigence is becoming increasingly apparent. This is in the summer of 1945. But then what's happening in 46 and 47, you've got the economic devastation on the continent. You also have the communist insurgency in Greece, which traditionally had been, in effect, protected by the British. And the British are out of money. They can no longer support.
They come to the United States and say, the world is yours.
Exactly.
There's some moment where that happens. That 46 where
that
happens?
46, and they come to, actually, Marshall was out of town, Secretary of State, then Secretary of State George Marshall is out of town, but they come to Undersecretary Dean Acheson and say, we're going to pull out our troops and our economic support for Greece. We can't afford it anymore. You guys need to pick up the baton or Greece might fall.
And might go commie.
Might go commie, and the Russians are already putting pressure on the Turks, and if Greece falls, they're going to feel encircled, and there go the Dardanelles and Black Sea. And so we need to get emergency aid to Greece and Turkey.
Right now.
Right now. Truman calls in the congressional leaders, including Vandenberg, and out of that emerges, there's first emergency aid to Greece and Turkey, and then out of that emerges the Truman Doctrine, calling for broader support. There's been a debate since 1947, when that speech happens early in 47, about whether Truman was too broad in this sort of, we're going to defend free peoples everywhere, and that may have had untold consequences for us leading right up to Vietnam. But Truman is calling for America to take a more assertive role in essentially resisting communist subjugation. And that's where Vandenberg is said to have made the apocryphal statement. Extensive research shows that he never actually said it, but it may capture the spirit of the occasion when Vandenberg, in that group of congressional leaders and with Marshall and Acheson, says to Truman, we'll support you, but you've got to scare the hell out of the American people. In other words, you've got to wake the American people up to this emerging communist threat.
We're not ready for this.
Right. We're still in the lingering aftermath of the war that we've won with the Russians.
And so he does that. There's the Iron Curtain speech by Churchill.
Well, and I have to back up just a moment on that, a cute moment. So Churchill gives the Iron Curtain speech in the spring of 46. And Churchill had used that term in Parliament, and he'd used that term in a letter to Truman. But it was a phrase that had never been used publicly in America. In the fall of 45, 6 months earlier, Vandenberg gives his Iron Curtain speech on the floor of the Senate.
Really?
And he was very proud of it. You know, Senate stationery sends out Raise the Iron Curtain, it was called.
Wow.
And
so he used it on American soil before Churchill did.
Correct.
Oh, that's unfair.
It's really fun. Well,
that's funny.
Well, the irony is, so he's very proud of the speech.
Yes.
He sends it out, but he sends it to his friend John Foster Dulles, who later was Eisenhower's Secretary of State. It happened the same week that Eisenhower had returned triumphantly from Europe, and that was big news, and Truman had issued a statement about the atomic bomb, and this is a few weeks after Hiroshima and Nagasaki that dominated the news. And so the news cycle ignored Vandenberg's speech. So John Foster Dulles writes him back and says, great speech, too bad nobody heard it, but I'm sure the phrasing will catch on.
And it sure does.
6 months later it in does. Fulton, Missouri, when Churchill gives his speech.
It's amazing. So one of the things I was struck by was that Vandenberg led and orchestrated, as part of scaring the American people and preparing the country for this, how many members of Congress went to Europe? Do you know?
Well, Vandenberg can't take credit for that. This was on the House side. Christian Herder led the Herder Committee, and something like 200 Americans.
Members of Congress.
200 congressmen. So obviously
about
preponderantly.
A congressional delegation of five today is a huge number.
Right.
They were ordered not to bring evening suits so that no one could say they were going to be on a junket.
Right.
Richard Nixon was a freshman member of Congress. He went and went to Italy and was shocked. It was a jarring thing. But did Vandenberg go over to Europe to see this?
Vandenberg had spent almost all of 1946 in Europe. I should back up a
really?
Little.
Really?
So in 45, he comes home from the UN conference in the summer of 45. And Truman says to Vandenberg and Connolly, I'd like you to go with the new Secretary of State then, James Burns, to Paris for the Council of Foreign Ministers to negotiate peace treaties wasn't with Germany proper, but it was with Italy and other countries that have fought with the Axis. And so Vandenberg and Connolly, fall of 45, is the first General Assembly meeting in London. We don't have a UN ambassador at that point. There's a delegation of four. Vandenberg, Connolly, Stettinius, who's still Secretary of State, and Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, really? Eleanor Roosevelt and Vandenberg had not been friendly at all. Vandenberg, as many Republicans did, viewed Eleanor
as a big lefty.
As the lefty voice whispering in FDR's ear. And she deeply resented his attacks on her husband. And so they sail from New York to Southampton together. And when they get there, Vandenberg writes actually to John Foster Dulles and says, you know, I take back everything I've said about her, and I've said plenty.
Really?
And at the end of their stint in London for that first General Assembly, she writes to Vandenberg practically begging him to stay on the delegation and saying, you know, we really need you. And he's saying, well, I got to get back to the Senate. But anyway, in the fall, they're in the General Assembly. They get back from London, and Truman again calls Vandenberg and Connolly, and now he's got Burns as Secretary of State, and says, I want you guys to go with him to Paris in the spring, and it ends up being spring, summer, and fall of 46. For these peace conferences. And so this is unprecedented in American diplomacy. You've got two senators who are joining the Secretary of State negotiating peace treaties. Vandenberg was reelected in 46 when the Republicans won their majority.
Yes.
He returns the day before the election. He's not campaigned at all.
So think about that. Season. Think about it. He didn't have to campaign to get reelected.
He had a weak opponent, but it was sort of pure prestige, I think, at that point.
He was an icon in Michigan politics by that time. We're going to have former Senator Spence Abraham, a former Republican Michigan senator, talk about the fact that he was a Coca-Cola of political brands by that time.
Well, and I think back then, senators had such stature that if you had reached that point, and he had, there was a hometown pride or a home state pride.
Yeah.
And we've got a guy who's pivotal in the world.
This guy was a very big deal.
Yeah. So to answer your question, he wasn't part of those delegations going in connection with the Marshall Plan. They had toured Germany. They had visited Berchtesgaden, the eagle's nest of Hitler.
Wow.
They'd traveled on Hitler's private train across Germany, viewing the devastation. So he was on intimate terms with the continent.
What is Vandenberg's legacy?
That elusive notion of bipartisanship. I mean, you back it up a little bit, and one of his pet phrases was politics stops at the water's edge. That notion of a united American front to the world. Of course, his success with bipartisanship came in a unique situation when Truman, as a new president, was in crucial times internationally, needing 2/3 votes in the Senate, so minority or majority, he needed the Republicans, and was willing to work with the Senate. Vandenberg's commitment to bipartisanship is certainly, that is sort of the iconic legacy. I would say another is his notion of being willing to change as the times change and make the move from what he thought served America best, which was neutrality prior to World War II, to a recognition that there was a leadership vacuum in the world that somebody had to fill, and we were the ones, if we didn't fill it, someone else would, mainly the Red Army on the continent of Europe. And so that notion of the necessity for American leadership is, I would say, another legacy.
Hank, this has been fabulous. Thank you for your time. Buy his book, Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century by Hank Meyer. Thanks, Hank.
It's a pleasure, Dan. Thank you so much.